think you can actually take it a step further, and if you actually apply a DC voltage, and when I say a DC voltage, I mean small, you know, it could be 1 volt or less, where you make the tank the cathode and your sacrificial rod, which is typically magnesium, you make that your anode, and that tank will last forever. The other thing I would do, Dick, is just for safety's sake, is make sure that you put at least a number 4 or better copper conductor between the cold and hot water pipes on the house side of your insulated joints, just to make sure that, God forbid, there's ever a ground fault or a hot bit of an easy way home. You know, in most cases, it would be a metallic bond between those pipes coupled through the tank, but since you're obviously insulated, you want to give it a safe way home. So I would go to number 4 or better and just put 2 pipe clamps right above the hot water heater. And I would think that you would be very, very safe that way. KD2, HUC.
CPZ with a quick answer.
Oh, fuck you, fuck you.
Steve, I'm glad you brought that up. You brought up a very good point. By way of the cold water pipe that goes straight to each of the sinks in the house and the tubs and whatever, and the hot water and cold water pipes are both grounded to those structures, there is complete connection there, but it's not guaranteed. I like your idea of putting that 4-gauge wire between the supply and the output pipe into my completely floating tank. And by the way, if I went the next step to make sure there's no galvanic action and I apply a small amount of voltage to my floating tank, which polarity would you put on that one, Steve? And by the way, for how long have you been doing oil service? Sounds to me like either you're in the business or you're also another guy that's very curious. KD2HUC, K2IW, the tech man.
DPZ with quickie answers.
Fuck you, Al.
Well, I'm actually not in the oil business, Dick, but few of my tasks at my job, I do oversee the electrolysis department. The voltage, the polarity that you would use is the tank should be the cathode, and the rod should be the anode of your supply. That is impressed current cathodic protection at its finest. It works, so. And you don't know if you had to hook that backwards, because that rod will disappear practically overnight, if you know what I mean. KD2, HUC.
CPZ with quick answers.
Steve, in my case, that galvanic rod, the sacrificial rod, is mounted on a plug that is screwed into the tank, therefore it is grounded to the tank. It is not electronically isolated from the tank. I think you're saying by way of Teflon tape or whatever, you would make sure that the plug holding the galvanic rod, the sacrificial rod, it is floating, and then you would put voltage on it, is what I think you're recommending. So that would be a change in the design of my particular hot water tank. Over to you, Steve. KD2HUC, K2RIW, and the tech man.
6DPZ, a quick answer. That's a correct statement, Dick. Yeah, it's grounded to the tank so that it allows natural current to flow. They refer to it as galvanic cathodic protection, which is where instruments in the anode protection to take place. Sometimes they need a little more help. So they use impressed current systems in which a DC power supply is used.
modify the sacrificial rod to make it isolated from the rest of the tank. It would be a change in design in the way mine is set up. Over to you, Steve.
Roger, if you're there, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Roger, please proceed.
Okay, this is Ed. I have a question. I was reading up on them, and I found a set of graphs that showed attenuation through the atmosphere at different frequencies, and I was interested to see that they were graphed against the dew point, which, by my understanding, is a measurement of how much water is in the air. And I'm just curious, what is the physical mechanism by which the amount of water in the air is so strongly affecting the attenuation of microwaves through the atmosphere?
Very fine, Ed. KC2PYT, KQIW, I made the mistake of calling you some of the name. Roger. Sorry about that, Ed. Turns out that water is a bipolar molecule. I'm not quite sure, but I think if you look at the way the diagram of a H2O molecule is usually shown, got the two H's on one side and the oxygen on the other side, so to speak, you would think the two hydrogen molecules, atoms, would be set off 180 degrees apart, 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock. They're offset at 10:30 and 1:30, so to speak. I think there's 109 degrees of angular distance between those two hydrogen molecules that are mated with that oxygen molecule to make a water molecule, two hydrogen atoms, I should have been saying. As such, one end of that molecule is positive, one end of the molecule is negative. When RF energy is applied to water, that molecule flips back and forth and follows each individual cycle of the RF energy. It is that mechanism that causes your microwave oven to do what it does. Let me drop it. You think your microwave oven is cooking your food. In reality, 90-some-odd% of what the microwave oven is doing is it's heating the water. The water molecule follows the RF energy bouncing back and forth on each half cycle, rotating back and forth on each half cycle. Well, the water molecules are also moving around very rapidly, hitting each other. And when they hit each other simultaneously to being rotated, the net result is that after the bounce, they're moving faster than before the bounce, because rotation is happening simultaneously with the bouncing. This is a concept that not many people know about. The air molecules in the room with you right now, believe it or not, at 70 degrees Fahrenheit, air molecules are moving 500 meters per second. 1.5 times the speed of sound is the average speed of the molecules of air. And the water molecules are doing something similar. I think the speed that they're moving is somewhat close to that number, something like 500 or 600 meters per second. So they're bumping into each other billions of times per second. At the same time, they're rotating, following the microwave signal. They end up moving faster. Temperature is average kinetic energy of the molecules in question. So the majority of what your microwave oven does is to heat water. Let me drop. So one way of looking at that whole situation is you could say that water is an extremely lossy material, particularly at microwave frequencies. Mr. Southworth, the guy who's got the credit for most of the invention of waveguide in the early days of the late 30s, literally using something that looked like downspout tubing that you would have for the rain house. Now got a wedge of water inside, and that became a perfect dummy load. The water would slowly, the radio wave would slowly be tapered into that water and get absorbed. So at each individual microwave frequency, the amount of water vapor absorption, microwave signal, is quite different. You get a huge spike of attenuation at around 24 or 23 gigahertz. That's the first resonance of a water molecule. But even at lower frequencies, your water vapor molecules are absorptive. So therefore, you've got these huge sets of curves that you can look up by going to the website of Dr. Tom Williams, WA1MBA. You go to WA1MBA.org, or is it .net? I'm not sure. I think it's .org. I don't think it's .com. I think it's .org. Tom Williams has a website which gives you lots of information if you're a microwave ham radio operator. And there you will find a whole set of curves of attenuation of the atmosphere versus frequency versus dew point, or you could call it humidity. The higher humidity will give you more atmospheric absorption of microwaves by way of the lossiness of the water itself because of the way the water molecule behaves. That's my understanding of it at KC2PYT, K2LIW in the TechMan.
Okay, so I understand it that far then. I guess a follow-up question is, for the frequencies at which water is not resonant, why is it still having such a pronounced effect?
Darn good question, and I'm glad you asked it, Ed. Notice that your microwave oven operates at 2450 megacycles. The early white microwave ovens used to operate at 900 megacycles. There was even a microwave oven that they tried experimenting at even lower frequencies yet. You are not using water vapor, water molecule resonance to operate a microwave oven. No matter what RF frequency you put into the water, that molecule is flipping back and forth following each half cycle of the RF energy. It's not resonance. It is a dipolar electrostatic attraction, and it's an electrostatic motor. Each individual water molecule, you could say, is an electrostatic motor. It's flipping back and forth on each half cycle of the RF energy, not resonance. The 2450 megacycles, let me drop. The 2450 megacycles of your microwave oven just happens to be a frequency that was left over that they decided to use. It's got nothing to do with the water vapor absorption. And a microwave oven, there's a zillion different frequencies you could operate it at, and it doesn't require resonance. Resonance is where the water vapor absorption higher, but when the water is already in liquid form, getting all the absorption you need. So that if your microwave oven worked at 24 gigahertz instead of 2.4 gigahertz, as long as you're heating water that's in the liquid form, which is the way it is in your food, you'd see very little improvement. And while we're talking about microwave ovens, I've got a whole series of information there that's highly misunderstood on microwave ovens. If you decided to test whether or not your particular piece of Tupperware is going to be good in a microwave oven, make sure there was a glass of water in the microwave oven when you do the test. Do the test without a glass of water. It is, in some cases, an invalid test. This is not an easy one to understand. Let me drop. The glass of water becomes a standard load so that the microwave oven does see something that can really be heating. And now the energy that's bouncing around the microwave oven that hits your Tupperware, if your Tupperware stays ice cold, it's real good. If it starts getting hot to the touch, it's not so good for a microwave oven. If you had nothing but the Tupperware in the oven itself, without the glass of water, the microwaves are going to bounce back and forth. Instead of three times and get absorbed by the glass of water, they're going to bounce 1,000 times to get absorbed by the Tupperware. In other words, the Tupperware is going to be seeing, in my example, 300 times more power flux density, milliwatts per square centimeter. It's an unreasonable test. On top of that, if your Tupperware happens to be very high in quality, the microwave oven will think it's thoroughly empty. Can we drop? If the microwave oven thinks it's thoroughly empty, and you're trying to, with the probe coming out of the magnetron, you're trying to launch 750 watts of RF energy at 2.45 gigahertz into that microwave oven, it's going to bounce around, it's got nothing to absorb it except the probe itself of the magnetron. That becomes the load if the microwave oven is empty. Therefore, all that energy bounces around and eventually goes back into the probe and back into the magnetron. You're now asking your magnetron to dissipate an extra 750 watts. Unless the designer of that magnetron was extremely conservative, there's a 50-50 chance you're going to burn it up. So you never want to run a microwave oven empty. I see some of these examples where people will put a soda bottle in a microwave oven, and if the glass is just barely lossy enough, you know, colored glass, they'll see the glass melt and they'll see arcing and sparking going on. When you're pushing the daylight on the performance of your microwave oven, when you put very low loss materials in there with nothing else, like a glass of water. K2LAW, you got it, Ed.
Okay, thanks a lot. lot. I think that answers my question satisfactorily. Have a great night, and I will be listening.
One other story that's very interesting about a microwave oven. You Google the word microwave oven inventor, and you'll hear the name Percy Spencer. He worked for the Raytheon Company roughly 1945 or so, and the story is that he was working on magnetrons or klystrons, high-power radar tubes, and it was possibly a summer day. He had a Mr. Goodbar candy bar in his pocket, and it melted. And he said, aha, the microwaves are doing that, and therefore he invented a microwave oven to create a small chamber where he heats his food. Good-sounding story. I think it's an urban legend. And maybe even he believed it. The candy bar that melted in his pocket was in his upper shirt pocket, and it melted because of the heat of his body. If there was enough microwave energy hitting that candy bar to melt it, that energy, I've been in those situations, that the microwave energy flashing at you for a brief period of time, you feel it immediately on your face, on your eyes, on your chest. If there was a strong enough microwave energy to melt the candy bar, his body would have recognized that immediately. It's not only a dangerous condition, but it would be a long time before it would melt the candy bar. That's the first part of the story that doesn't ring true. Here's another part of the story. Go out and buy a Mr. Goodbar candy bar, which has changed very little in the design all of these years. Make sure you mount it on a foam block that holds it an inch or more above the glass tray at the bottom of your microwave oven. There's a funny dielectric effect between the chocolate and the glass. You don't want the chocolate sitting directly on the glass. Take a very low-loss kind of foam, like the kind of foam that you can buy for insulation that goes into your house. It's a very low-loss polyethylene material. Take a small chunk of that, put your Mr. Goodbar on top of that foam in the microwave oven with a glass of water. Turn on the microwave oven for 1 minute at full blast power, 750 watts. At the end of that minute, the glass of water will be almost boiling and the chocolate bar will be... There's nothing. I did the same... pumpkin time, you know what I mean. Halloween. And so we had a whole bunch of kinds of candy bars around and I tested them. Very few of the candy bars will absorb any substantial amount of microwave, but a Mr. Goodbar stays ice cold. So the story is doubly wrong. His body would have sensed the heat of the microwaves immediately. He would have backed away from it. There would never be enough heat to melt that candy bar in his upper vest pocket of his shirt, of his dress shirt. On top of that, the Mr. Goodbar doesn't respond to microwaves. Now, there's a slim possibility. Let me drop. That a Mr. Goodbar operates at some other frequency where it's absorbed to. That's a long shot, and I doubt it. The particular microwave tube he was testing at the time, for all I know, it was at 24 gigahertz, so to speak, and maybe then the microwave would have a little bit more of an effect on a Mr. Goodbar. But even then, his body would respond immediately because a human being has got a high percentage of water. When it comes to microwave energy, you're extremely absorptive. If you look at the curve of maximum permitted exposure for the United States, the IEEE, American National Standard Institute C95 report, the defining document for the United States, for OSHA, NIOSH, and Department of Defense. You take a look at that document and you'll see that from 1500 megahertz and above, what happens is that 80% of the energy that hits your body gets reflected off of the skin and only 20% gets absorbed and turned into heat. So above 1500 megahertz, you're 5-to-1 safer with microwaves than you are at 30 to 300 megs, the so-called UHF region, where almost 100% of the RF energy hitting you gets turned into heat. So the Percy Spencer story of the inventor of the microwave oven, I think has got a number of errors, and I think it's more of an urban legend the way it's explained, as you can see what I'm saying. Hey, with any further comments on this, give me a call. It is right now, K2RIW on the TechNet. Okay, the next person that was on our list, right now, I think, Joe, if you're available, you could give us your information. W2BMP, if you're available. K2RIW, the TechNet. Go right ahead, Joe. Okay. Okay, and I think we also had K2JAS, K2 Juliet Alpha Sierra. If you're available, go right ahead with your question or comment. K2RAW and TechNet, my name is Dick.
Good evening, Dick. It's Roger. If you would automatically replace a hot water heater that was 15 years old.
Okay, would I automatically replace a hot water heater that's 15 years old, knowing that maybe it's about to spring a leak because of its age, and there is a definite possibility of that. And when they do spring a leak, oh boy, by the time you discover it, you might have 6 inches of water in your basement, if you know what I mean. Some people will put a moat around the hot water heater with a moisture sensing device in order to set off an alarm to let them know that the hot water heater is leaking, so that they can catch it before it fills up the basement with water. The first thing that you really should do, in my opinion, and it's sometimes very difficult, is to remove that plug that holds the sacrificial rod. And if you look at the case, if you look at the status of the sacrificial rod, which, by the way, is a replaceable item, you go to a place like Sid Harvey, among other places, plumbing supply houses, you can buy a replacement sacrificial rod, the magnesium rod. That's what's protecting the tank from galvanic action. If you take that rod out of there and look at it, and if it's in good shape, you might not have to replace the tank. If the rod is half eaten through, two things are taking place. Let me drop it. First of all, I'm not sure of the exact number, but maybe it's once every 5 years. You're supposed to either check on or replace that sacrificial rod. Most of us don't do that. But if you're really being diligent, you're supposed to be checking on that rod periodically. I'm going to guess it's something like once every 5 years, 3 years, something like that. Second of all, you're probably going to need an impact wrench to open up that plug. Because if your tank is more than 5 or 10 years old, that plug that holds down the sacrificial rod is rusted and welded in place. You're not going to just simply put your Stilson wrench on there and open it. It's going to take an impact wrench to open it. And so that's a problem. If you can't get to that rod, then there's no good way to find out whether or not the tank has broken some of its internal glass insulating structure and is starting to eat away someplace and it's about to spring a leak. So at 15 years, my experience in my particular house with the amount of galvanic action that I get, let me drop. I know that I would spring a leak within something like 15 years on the tanks that I've had. So it is something to definitely worry about as I see it, Roger, because with that length of time, if it suddenly springs a leak, and you know the way Murphy's Law is, it's going to spring a leak on the day that you're away for a weekend. By the time you come home, the house is almost ready to float away. I'm being a little bit dramatic here, but I've had a problem like that that happened to me once. K2JAS, K2RAW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. You've answered my question, and I just double-checked the install date, and the tank is 19 years old, and it's got to be replaced now. But it only gets used for 6 months of the year, so I was just wondering if that helps.
I'm not sure that's a big factor, the fact that it only gets used 6 months a year. Yes, when it's heated and it's doing its job, I am guessing that galvanic action takes place more rapidly. There's a universal law of chemistry that says every time you raise the temperature of the material that's undergoing a reaction, every time you raise the temperature by 10 degrees centigrade, the rate of the reaction will double. That's a universal law of chemistry. That's true in a lot of cases. So if your tank is running cold 6 months out of the year, then whatever action is taking place probably is taking place a hell of a lot slower. That's one thing in your favor. But under normal circumstances, 19 years is a lot of years on a hot water heater for the way I used to have mine set up. I wouldn't survive that long. But like you, I've until recently, I was very negligent on testing the status of that sacrificial magnesium rod. We're supposed to be testing that, and most of us don't do it. I've got a different attitude about that these days, as you can tell. Good luck with that, Roger. When you do replace the tank, you being the kind of a scientist I think you are, let me drop it. It would be very interesting to look into all of the connectors and see if you see any evidence of corrosion having taken place where you were about to get a failure. And maybe there's even a way that you can shine a flashlight inside and see what the real status is of the tank itself. In the case of the one that sprung the Great Big Leak, in my case, the leak was in the tank near the bottom. And by the way, you're supposed to also open up that valve periodically to drain out the particles that fall to the bottom of the tank. You don't do all these things, but you're supposed to be doing that. So when you do replace it, and it sounds like you're going to, see what you can do to find out how close you came to a disaster and come back and report it to us, Roger. Interesting material. K2JIS.
This is K2JIS, and I can't thank you enough for your great input. I really do appreciate listening to you and getting your feedback on these things. I'll be in listening mode. Back to you, K2JIS.
Very fine, Roger. And you guys got to be a little bit careful. I've got a whole lot of opinions on a whole lot of areas, and I'm telling you where the opinions are coming from. I can't guarantee that I'm right all the time. Some of the things I say have got some errors, so be a little bit careful. Your mileage may vary, if you know what I mean. I think we've gone down the list of people who signed in who are able to talk to us. One last call. Is anyone else who signed in earlier and wants to ask a question? Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
K2LIW in the TechNet. This is Citizens DPZ with a quickie answer stick.
Okay, I think we're hearing you now. I think we're hearing you now, Hal. Go ahead, Hal.
Thank you, Dick. Now, what I wanted to explain was, which I got rudely interrupted, that when the discussion of grounding came up, what I wanted to say was basically on a lot of the older ham radio equipment from, let's say, the 70s and the 80s, they had basically two wire cords, be it the FT-101, the 520, a lot of other amateur radio gear. A good thing to do is take the power cord, rewire it, use a three-wire cord. Computer cords are very cheap at Hamfest. You buy them for next to nothing. Rewire the thing with a three-wire, take the green lead, ground it to the chassis. The reason being, some of the older equipment, the transformer can break down, and you'll have... K2LIW, am I still getting through?
The first half, yes, and then something changed, Hal. Go ahead.
Okay, did you get most of it?
I'm hearing you on the input, Hal. I'll repeat it. Hal's suggestion was that in the older pieces of equipment that some of us own, the older pieces of equipment that only had a two-wire cord, Hal's recommending that you take a real modern-day three-wire cord with three prongs to it and cut off the end of it if need be and mount that onto your older piece of equipment that had a two-wire cord and you take the green lead and make the plugs really quite dangerous, and the equipment that's got those should be replaced with a modern-day three-wire plug. I can remember a slight version of this that I ran into, my Heathkit AR3 receiver back in the early 50s. It had a two-wire plug to it. It also had a pair of something like 0.01 disc ceramic capacitors because of that divider capacitor network. I can remember one day coming down to my basement where the ham shack was, with my bare feet, standing on the concrete floor and touching the chassis of the Heathkit receiver, and remember feeling that 67 volts. So I saw lots of evidence of even without a transformer breakdown, there was a dangerous condition going on there. So you really should be very wary about using older radio equipment that's got a two-wire plug. I wonder if you want to add anything to that, Hal. I'll hear you on the input. K6DPZ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Just for safety, and in case that we resell, I make sure for liability purposes, go ahead.
You weren't coming through, but I was repeating you from another means. Hal, I was taking you from the input and repeating you by another means. So Hal was repeating to us the fact that the older pieces of equipment, particularly at schools that he gets a hold of, can be dangerous. So take a good hard look at that power cord and be willing to change it to a real three-wire cord. Don't continue to use two-wire cords because they can be kind of risky. Okay, time for the mailbag, John. And as I gave you guys a warning earlier, you're going to be getting a little bit of a mini lecture on the subject of radar because John received an extremely interesting question about radar, that the guy is doing a kind of homebrew radar setup. And of all the kinds of radio equipment we all use, arguably some of the most exciting equipment that can give you some very interesting results is radar-like systems. KC2 WGB, K2RIW, you got it, John.
KC2 WGB, are you hearing me, Dick? And also, did you hear Paul check in tonight?
Not yet, but I'm not worried. Paul is always there. If all goes well, he'll be giving us referring to. You've got it, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
All right, I'm here. WS2N.
I knew he would be. You got it, John.
Now I can find out what's happening to my Pluto pictures. All right. Let me drop it. I've got an easy question first. Okay, Dick, I have a young gentleman who was listening to your discussion about these anechoic chambers, and he was wondering that, being that those cones, as I call them, are absorbent, or pyramids, if you want to call them that, he wanted to know, have you ever run into a situation where radar power is such a high level, heated them up, destroyed them, or melted them to and destroyed them? Have you ever run into that? And could that happen? Over to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Wow. Is that a question? And am I the guy to ask that question to? Let me tell you a really sad story. Stand by. I sound a little bit better through this rig, so I'll use this one until we run into a problem. The year was 1977. Location was Airborne Instruments Laboratory, Deer Park, New York. A man who should remain nameless, a manager, was doing the testing of the jamming pod that goes on an EA-6B airplane. The Navy EA-6B carrier-based airplane has these jamming pods that hang below the pylon of an airplane wing. It's got a ram air turbine, a propeller on the front end of it. So when the airplane is flying at, let me pick a number, 300 miles an hour, the air hitting that propeller on the front end of this pod that's hanging below the wing of the airplane gives lots of kilowatts of electrical power. The pod of RF power comes out of that standoff jammer. And so what the airplane normally does is it flies in a racetrack pattern a couple of hundred miles from a radar that you want to jam, and it creates such a strong amount of signal that you create a carrier, you create a corridor of jammed direction in that particular azimuth of a radar. Therefore, you can fly your attack airplanes down that corridor that's being protected by that standoff jammer. That took place during the Gulf War when Baghdad was being bombed the first time. Each of those pilots flying an F-117 said, I want to be double darn sure I'm safe. I want to make sure there's an EA-6B standoff jammer out there at the same time that I'm flying my airplane down there, down this corridor into Baghdad to drop some bombs. Let me drop. Okay, so one of those jamming pods was going to be tested at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and it's a great big 100-foot-long chamber. I think it's 100-foot-long. Yeah, it was a 100-foot-long chamber. I forget how many megabucks the chamber was valued at. And the normal holding stand that would hold up the pod to test it in that chamber, for some reason, that holding stand wasn't available. So what this manager said was, we'll just set up the jamming pod on a piece of foam and we'll test it in this chamber. He happened to pick up a piece of walk-on radar absorbing material, walk-on RAM we call it. In other words, you take those pyramids of absorbing material, you put some extra foam on top, and you put a hard surface above that made out of plastic that you could walk on. All right. A piece of that material, which stands about 3 foot high, was sitting in the chamber. He moved that block of walk-on material into the middle of the chamber, put the anechoic, put the jamming pod on top of that, turned, enabled it, you know, connected all the electrical connections, walked out of the chamber, closed the door, and turned on the jamming pod. The jamming pod put out lots of power. That power and RF energy coming out of the jamming pod went into that walk-on RAM material, which didn't have airflow because it was walk-on material. There wasn't even any airflow around those pyramids. To make a long story short, it got so hot it caught on fire. The bottom line is it burned down the whole darn chamber. The whole darn chamber caught on fire. The fire extinguishers, if there were any, weren't able to handle this. And when the fire department came in to put out that fire, because burning polyurethane creates, let me drop it. When urethane burns, it releases a cyanide-bearing gas. I guess I'll have to flip over to the other machine. Is that right? It puts out a cyanide-bearing gas. The cyanide-bearing gas was very dangerous for the firemen that were trying to put out this fire. A number of those firemen got very sick. But a multi-million-dollar chamber, a $250,000 jamming pod, all got burned to the ground because of the RF energy being absorbed into those pyramids that was being put out by that jamming pod. That was an event that I personally witnessed in roughly 1977 at AIL, and I saw that fire, I saw this chaos that ensued, and because it is a secure facility, just for the fire department to get their trucks onto the facility, to get them past the guard booth and the chain link fence, and for people to find the right keys to open up the locks. Oh boy, this was a Chinese fire drill. By the time they finally got the fire trucks to the chamber, half the chamber was already burned, and now they're putting out the fire of the chamber, which is outside of the main building, to make sure you don't burn down the rest of the building. And as I said, firemen on their ladder truck squirting water into that flame were breathing those fumes and got very sick. A huge event, as you can tell. So that's quite a question he asked, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW. I lived through that history.
W2RIY, what a question on what you just talked about.
Go ahead, John. I mean, Joe, sorry about that.
Before this event took place, did you tell him the right thing to do, and he chose not to do it?
Not at all. I wasn't in the chamber at the time. This was a test that was going on that particular program. I was on another program, although my particular office was only about 100 feet, 150 feet away from that chamber. And so when that fire started, we knew about it real soon. No, it wasn't. He wasn't ignoring the words being given to him by anybody. He had made a decision that, hey, I want to test this chamber right now. I want to test this jamming pod right now. We happen not to have the right test equipment, but I'm going to innovate. I'm going to change the normal procedure and go out and do it. And he had a very not-so-great reputation after that. I think that's sort of what you're asking, but no, there was nobody around at the time to tell him not to do that. He was doing this without the normal chamber operators being present. They would have told him that this was crazy. He had a technician working with him that was not a chamber savvy human being. So there's a comedy of errors here, Joe. To be 2RYY, K2RIW, and the tech man.
I was just wondering. Okay, I was just wondering.
Back to you, John. KC2WGB in the mailbag. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. All right, Nick. Well, that's good information. That's exactly what he asked, though. You were there and you saw it. I do have a further additional question on that, though. If you had another set of those conical or those pyramid cones, and you said it, say, 15 feet in front of that. Would that also have enough energy at that distance to melt that or set that on fire?
My gut feel on that one, John, is absolutely not. RF energy almost always obeys the inverse square law. In this particular case, the absorbing material was probably 8 inches away from the actual antennas, squirting out very high power microwaves inside of that fiberglass radome of that jamming pod. So a very close spacing. I am guessing probably 5 feet of spacing between the jamming pod and the anechoic material, the absorbing material, would have kept it from catching on fire, particularly if it also wasn't walked on ram. In other words, if the pyramids were exposed to air, so a real airflow could take a place. This walk-on ram is a thoroughly sealed material, if you know what I mean. There's no airflow going on inside. Therefore, it had no way of cooling itself. But every time you double the distance between a transmitting antenna and whatever the devices you're testing, human being, absorbing material, whatever, every time you double the distance, the inverse square law says it's going to fall off by 6 dB, a 4-to-1 ratio, every time you double the distance. So to go from 8 inches to 5 feet would have been enough decibels of what we call free space loss, not really loss. If I put a 100-watt light bulb inside of a spherical room, and if the spherical room just happens to have an area of 100 square meters, 100-watt light bulb putting out 100 watts of light, I'm going to say, 100 watts of heat, going into 100 square, and I'm assuming the light bulb is isotropic, radiating in all directions, because you know the area that is absorbing it, 100 square meters, and it's 100 watts, you know you're going to be getting very close to 1 watt per square meter of...
Repeater, time out.
You know you're going to be getting very close to 1 watt per square meter of energy into that room. Now, if I made the room twice the diameter, I've now got twice the area, see, pi r squared, no, I got 4 times the area. So if I made the room twice as big, a spherical room, I now have 1/4 of a watt per square meter on every square meter of the room. So when I went from whatever distance was the 100 square meter spherical room to a 400 square meter spherical room, which is twice the radius, I've now doubled the distance between the light bulb and the wall of that spherical room. I've got 6 dB less energy because area is 4 pi r squared. You can see that you're now seeing an example of inverse square law. I've doubled the distance, you get 1/4 of the power. Well, I happen to have 4 times the area. You could say you've got 6 dB of extra free space loss. As you can see, it's not really loss. All the 100 watts is being absorbed by that 400 square foot room, the twice the area room. Still being absorbed. The air has no loss. To a simple measurement, when you double the distance, it looks like you've got 6 dB of extra loss. But when you look at it in a spherical point of view, it ain't loss, just the energy is going somewhere else. I don't know if that makes a little more sense, John. KC2WGB, K2IW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Yes, makes perfect sense. All right, that just about covers that subject. Very good. Now, I have an announcement to make for a gentleman who's asking a question. Let me let it drop. Okay. In the chat room, KD2GUZ, your question was answered last week. You had sent it in 2 weeks ago, covered it last week because it came in too late 2 weeks ago. So it played back Mike Perry's website, amateur.tv, can hear your question being answered by Dick on that show. Just make sure I got the right website there, Dick. KC2WGB, back to you.
Yes, amateurradio.tv. Amateur radio, no punctuation, no spaces. Amateurradio.tangovictor. And there, you'll see the last 9 years of recordings. And each week that we have a TechNet, it takes about 3, 4, 5 days for that particular recording to appear on the website. But except for a couple of errors that have creeped in once in a while, everything gets recorded and you can play it back, and that makes our material peer-reviewed material. When we make a mistake, somebody playing it back lets us know about it real fast. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Very good. Yes, this amateur is the person who asked a question about the abandoned telephone line being used for shortwave reception, and you covered that pretty thoroughly. All right, let me let it drop, and I'm going to my next question. Okay, we have this amateur who's playing with this little monostatic radar problem. Basically, he's working at 800 megahertz, has two Yagis, well-tuned for that frequency, separated by approximately 100 feet. What does he need to do? Transmit from the first antenna, which is the transmit antenna, to the receiving antenna, which he has a length of cable, I believe he said it was like 7 feet, unterminated or terminated, which will cause a reflection of that signal down the cable coming back. What he wants to know is, will that transmitting antenna, or the receiving antenna, transmit that absorbed signal, and would he be able to detect that, and what do you think the chances are? Maybe you can make some recommendations. Back to you, to KC2WGB.
There's a lot of variables in this particular problem, and there's a lot of interesting information here. Arguably some of the most exciting pieces of electronics mankind has ever created in the radio world is radar equipment, and this is a kind of a radar experiment that we're discussing right now. And is the signal being re-reflected by that receiving antenna detectable? Absolutely. If and only if that radar is set up just right. I'm going to give you some of the variables involved, but I'm going to walk you into this problem slowly. This is the so-called mini-lecture I decided to give you guys on the subject of radar tonight. And one of the first questions somebody's going to ask, which is inadvertently in this question, is, if I set up a kind of a radar-like system, what is the range of targets that I can measure? Can I measure a target 10 feet away, 10 miles away, 100 miles away? Can I measure the reflection from that target? In most cases, the answer is yes, if you do it right. But let's just talk about radar propagation in one direction, because the way a radar works is it transmits a brief pulse of energy in some particular direction. The way Mother Nature's radio waves behave is they want to go through nothing but clear air, 377 ohms per square, 377 ohm impedance air, and anything you put in that air, I don't care if it's an insulating material like a block of wood, a 2x4, or a chunk of metal, no matter what you put in that air, you're changing the impedance, and you're going to be getting some reflection from it. And if your radar is set up properly and has enough sensitivity, you will see that echo. Let me drop. In fact, no matter how hard you try, if you use the world's best Delphi techniques, the faceting techniques of an F-117 fighter airplane or a B-2 airplane, I mean, these are efforts where billions of dollars have gone into making sure that the echo is as weak as you can get it. Doesn't mean the echo has disappeared. You just made it so many decibels weaker that it requires a heroic effort to see the echo of those particular aircraft. It's not zero. You've knocked it down by 20, 30, 40 dB. You may have made the echo of that aircraft equal to the echo of a mosquito if you're really good, but it's still detectable if the equipment is sensitive enough. Well, let's talk about that a little bit. First of all, to give you a simple example, your handy talkie. Assume I've got a 5-watt, 2-meter handy talkie in my hand, and I own a pair of them. Let me drop. And I take these pair of 2-meter, 5-watt handy talkies. I hand one to a friend, and I'm standing out in front of my house. And I tell my friend to start walking away with that handy talkie. Let's see what kind of range we get. By the time he gets about 2 miles away from you, under normal circumstances, maybe 3 miles, the signal is going to start getting kind of ratty. So you would say handy-talkie to handy-talkie on an ordinary residential street. By the time you walk a couple of miles, the signal's getting pretty weak. If by comparison I was standing on a tall building and I'm talking to a guy with a mobile 2-meter rig with a whip antenna on the top of the car, maybe I could drive as much as 15 to 20 miles before I start getting a ratty signal. Okay, take that exact same 5-watt handy-talkie and put it in the space shuttle when it's flying over Texas, 1,500 miles away. Astronaut Owen Garriott is talking with a Motorola 5-watt handy-talkie into a tape antenna, a foil antenna that's taped to the window of the space shuttle. He's transmitting a signal 1,500 miles away from northern Texas, and with my 5/8 wave whip antenna on my automobile in the parking lot of AIL, I'm hearing that transmission 10-15 dB signal to noise ratio from 1,500 miles. Think about that. 5-watt handy-talkie, handy-talkie to handy-talkie, 3 miles is difficult. To a mobile rig with good line of sight, maybe 20 miles, we get some real clear space altitude, like a 180-mile high space shuttle, 1,500 miles is accommodated. And now take that same 5-watt transmitter, make it 6 watts, move the frequency a little bit up to 8 gigs, and put it on the Voyager. Voyager is out there 12 billion miles, 3 times the distance to Pluto. And it's
repeater, timeout.
It's 12 billion miles away, 3 times the distance to Pluto, and Voyager is talking to us with a 6-watt transmitter. Not just a little bit different than a 5-watt handy-talkie. So what's the real range of a 5-watt transmitter? As you can see, it depends. Depending on the conditions and the frequency you're using and the antennas you're using. I'll admit that Goldstone is a 240-foot dish doing the receiving, and the 8 or 9-foot diameter dish that's on Voyager, the antennas really make a good piece of hardware that works very well as the transmitter. So a 6-watt transmitter can be talked to from 12 billion miles away if the conditions are right. Okay, radar has a degree of similarity to this. By that I mean the signal is going out in one direction, and whether it goes 3 miles or 12 billion miles, you know something about what the loss is going to be like in one direction. The signal is then going to hit an echoing device, and you know what the loss is going to be like when it comes back. So it's all calculatable. The smartest way to set up this radar system, if you want the greatest sensitivity, is to not transmit and receive with one single antenna. Because unless you're very smart with the way you set up the equipment, the transmit-receive relay, you want the pulse coming out of the transmitter to go to the antenna and not go to the receiver. Then during the receiving period, you want to flip the switch so that the signal coming back now only goes to the receiver and not to the transmitter. The amount of speed it takes and the amount of isolation of that transmit-receive relay is a very important factor. Let me drop. And a real radar does something kind of magic that's not obvious at first. Some of the radars I've worked on use a magnetron tube. What the magnetron tube consists of is a 12,000-volt power supply that is hooked up to a pulse-forming network. The pulse-forming network makes a video pulse that's, say, 5 microseconds long, 12,000 volts. The 12,000 volts, 5 microsecond long video pulse goes into the magnetron tube, and during that 5 microseconds, the tube puts out a couple of kilowatts of power. When the video pulse out of the pulse-forming network is gone, there's essentially 0 volts on that magnetron tube, and it's putting out absolutely no noise. Take an ordinary signal generator that has a BNC connector on the front panel, which is called pulse input. What that thing is doing is it's turning on the oscillator and applying it to the final stage amplifier of that signal generator. Let me drop. So you're making a pulse of drive signal to the final stage, but the final stage is sitting there continuously exercising its gain, waiting for another pulse to come to its input. That final stage might have 20 decibels of gain and might